We have four amazing speakers here tonight. Barbara Dudley is a family farmer, an adjunct professor at Portland State University, former president of the National Lawyers Guild, and former director of Greenpeace, and currently state co-chair of the Working Families Party of Oregon. She was instrumental in bringing the party here to Oregon and initiating the proposal for the state bank. Jim Hauser is co-owner of the Hawthorne Auto Clinic and co-chair of Main Street Alliance of Oregon. Some of you may recognize his name. Last Thursday, he was mentioned by President Obama in the State of the Union Address. An acknowledgement of his commitment to provide insurance to his employees, and as such will benefit from the new health care law. Teresa Retzloff is also a family farmer. Her farm, 46 North, is located in Astoria. As an active member of Friends of Family Farmers, an organization focused on promoting policies and programs that protect and expand the ability of family farmers to run a successful business. She's a writer and chronicles her experiences in her blog, 46 North Farm. We will be graced by State Representative Jefferson Smith, which is District 47, east of 205. He is a native Oregonian and founder of the Bus Project, a nonprofit organization which engages young people to get involved in progressive politics and progressive issues. Tonight's discussion consists of two parts, a presentation by the speakers, followed by a question and answer period. We invite you to, we'll have a roving microphone, and we invite you to ask questions and just limit your responses to questions only, please. And we also have comment cards for those people who feel they would rather have someone else answer those questions. And we would like to continue this discussion beyond this evening. So please feel free to fill out this pink contact form so we can continue to update on our efforts. And if you've not done so already, tell your legislators that you support an Oregon State Bank. On this flyer, you'll find a website where you can essentially send an e-postcard to your state representatives. Thank you, and without further hesitation, our panel.
Thanks, Tarana, and thank you all for being here. I want to just set the record straight. I am not a family farmer. My family has a farm. I, however, am really useless at the farm. So we grow grapes and make wine, and I help with the consumption, and that's as much as I can contribute. So I don't want to take credit where it is. It is a lot. It's true. And I'm a known taster. Okay. So I'm curious how many of you were present at the economic crisis town hall 2 years ago, almost exactly 2 years ago. Right on. Because that really is the origin of the Oregon State Bank campaign. We came together, there were some 800 of us who came together January 31st, 2009. So it was right in the early stages of the meltdown on Wall Street. And we spent a lot of time in the morning there talking about how that meltdown had happened, about the deregulation of the financial services industry, about the coziness of the investment banks with the federal government, about the failures of the Federal Reserve, and to say nothing about the SEC and the rest of the regulators, about the free trade agenda, which through its financial services agreement virtually mandates further deregulation of financial services globally. We talked about incredibly risky investing that had been going on in Wall Street, about the leveraging at 40 to 1 when it should have been down by 10 to 1. We talked about the now very infamous credit default swaps, and we looked at what was starting then, just starting, to happen to Main Street as a result of this kind of behavior on Wall Street. That was the morning. Then in the afternoon, we started to talk about what we could do about it. And that was the part that I found really extraordinary and a tribute, I think, to Jobs with Justice and the other organizations that came together to put that day together for us so that we would not leave feeling disempowered. We started talking about our economy as though it was something we could have some control over. And simply through that conversation, we began to take control. We talked about a lot of things. We talked about supporting local businesses. We talked about supporting local farmers. We talked about farmers markets. We talked about co-ops. We talked about building more locally based enterprises. All of those things that we thought we could do so that we could begin to build something solid here in Oregon that wouldn't be so much at the mercy of Wall Street's vagaries. And we launched one of the first Move Your Money campaigns in the entire country, which we called in true Portland fashion, Fire Your Bank. We encouraged people to move their money to local banks, to take it out of the big banks, the too big to fail banks, and into locally owned banks and credit unions. We also started a process at that point of talking to community bankers and credit unions, to farmers and to small business owners, and we've continued that for 2 years now. And in the course of doing that, we were trying to figure out what it was that made what happened on Wall Street so very devastating to us here 3,000 miles away. And a big piece of that was that credit simply was not moving. Because the Wall Street banks had imploded, there was no longer any way for the smaller, more local banks to actually get the participation loans and the funding that they needed to keep credit flowing to local businesses. People here in Oregon were losing their jobs and losing their homes because Wall Street had gorged itself. So we began to turn our attention to the question of banks. Why weren't they lending? Why were so many of them closing? And yes, it's true that some of them had been making unwise loans, just as many homeowners had taken on silly mortgage deals that they never should have gotten involved in. But most of them were simply caught in the crunch through no fault of their own. And the question began to evolve, could the state help? Because the state of Oregon, as small a state as it is, has in its coffers some 60, it used to be 80, billion dollars. And the question is, what was happening with that money? Well, of course, what was happening with that money was it was being invested in Wall Street banks, in private equity funds, in hedge funds. It was being invested in Wall Street, and through Wall Street, it was being invested globally. Very few of those dollars were being put to work here in Oregon. And probably very few of them were being put to work in the United States. So the question came to us, what if some of those dollars, not the trust funds, not PERS, but just the more liquid assets of the state, could be put to use by partnering with community banks and credit unions, could be put to use to start providing lines of credit again to qualified borrowers, to small businesses and farmers who had viable business plans, to get them moving again so that they could start hiring again, so that people could start working again, so people could start moving their own economy forward. So we looked at the model of the Bank of North Dakota, which was started in 1919 in a very similar economic and historical period. The Bank of North Dakota remains today very viable and very popular. And North Dakota, in case you don't know, is a very Republican state. They love their state bank. It does not compete, nor would ours compete with credit unions or community banks. Rather, it would partner with them. It would lead to a much healthier local banking sector than most states have, than we have right now. It would serve as a banker's bank and not a retail bank. It would help to prevent bank consolidation. As we lose our small community banks around the state, the bigger banks are gobbling them up. And we're seeing more and more and more consolidation. The question, the underlying question in this campaign is, do we want a healthy, diverse, robust local banking system? And to me, the answer is obvious, yes. If we don't have a local banking system, we do not have the tools to have a truly local economy. It's different from just a state lending program in that the bank, would fund economic development programs through revenues it generates itself from more market-driven lending. In other words, this is a revenue center. This is not something which costs the state money. This is something which, in the long run, not tomorrow, not immediately, will start to make money for the state and actually put money back into either the general fund or the rainy day fund, rather than costing us. It saves the bank, it could save, if it's structured properly, it could save the bank millions of dollars in banking fees as well. In other words, this is a big idea. This is a very important change that we could do to get a grip on our own economy. It bridges party divides. It bridges the rural-urban divide in this state. It is every bit as important for small towns in rural Oregon, for farmers in rural Oregon, as it is for small businesses here in Portland or in Eugene or in Salem. And it also bridges this divide that we're seeing growing now between public sector and private sector unions. Because it doesn't pit one against the other, looking at a constantly shrinking hole. Instead, it says, let's get a grip on our own economy and build something for the future that is ours in Oregon, that we can have control over whether or not Wall Street manages to survive. And some of us could hope it doesn't. We have received very positive support in the legislature for this idea. We've received support from both parties, and in fact, during the election season, the nomination season, the Working Families Party made this one of our top priorities and got commitments at that time from 30 candidates who are now translated into 24 members of the current legislature who were already committed to supporting a state bank, because they had received the Working Families Party nomination. One of those, a Republican from Pendleton, Bob Jensen, has now introduced a state bank bill. It's HB 2972. That's an excellent bill. And the fact that it comes from rural Oregon says a lot about what this will do for us in the future. So I'm going to stop there, because there's going to be plenty of time for questions afterwards for those of you who want more details or more explanations of one part or another of this. And I'm going to go to Teresa and Jim, I can't remember in which order, Jim and then Teresa, to talk about why this is so essential for our businesses. Thank you.
Well, good evening. Thank you for having me here. My name is Jim Hauser, and I'm co-owner of Hawthorne Auto Clinic here in Portland and co-chair of the Main Street Alliance of Oregon. I want to thank the Oregonians for a State Bank Coalition for putting on this forum and for inviting me to share the perspective of small business owners in Oregon. The Main Street Alliance of Oregon, formerly the Oregon Small Business Council, came together in 2008 to add a real voice for small business to the national healthcare debate. Since then, we have begun to broaden the scope of our work to other issues that have impact on small business owners, including financial reform, tax policy, and the environment. Most recently, we decided to take a look at the credit crunch and the negative effects it is having on Main Street businesses. To get a true picture, we met with small business owners around the state to discuss their credit needs and the troubles they were having accessing credit. What we found was that 54% of small business owners surveyed had felt the tightening of credit since the recession began, and they had to take sometimes drastic measures to keep their businesses afloat, often known as a Visa card. In the case of Hawthorne Auto Clinic, for some time we have considered expanding our business to include converting customers' Toyota Priuses to plug-in hybrid electric vehicles, or PHEVs. Portland has the highest concentration of Priuses nationally, and the upgrade can almost double the Prius fuel economy. The conversion in our own Prius has provided 2 years of trouble-free and ultra-efficient driving. But adding this new line of business would likely require numerous additional investments in building expansion, training, and tooling, and conversion component acquisition. The benefits would not only increase employment and revenue for Hawthorne Auto Clinic, but also increase employment and economic growth for the construction company building our addition, the component manufacturers, the product shipping companies, etc. The extended recovery from the Great Recession has made us extremely wary of new financial commitments and uncertain of the availability of the necessary financing. The possibility of a state-owned bank in Oregon making financing available for community banks to loan to qualifying small businesses makes it much more likely that we will be able to grow and expand into new markets. Looking back at our survey work, there is overwhelming support for small business owners from small business owners around the state for the creation of such a bank in Oregon, and I and the Main Street Alliance of Oregon applaud the efforts of this coalition. Thank you.
I'd also very much like to thank Oregonians for State Bank for putting this forum on. This is a wonderful discussion I think we're going to have. My name is Teresa Retzloff, and I and my partner Packy own 46 North Farm. We're just north east of Astoria on the north coast of Oregon. We started farming on the north coast of Oregon just outside of Seaside in 2003 and ran a small farm there on land that we leased from friends for a number of years. And over the years, we built a strong small farm selling herbs, salad greens, flowers, edible plant starts. We marketed to local farmers markets and direct to customers. We went through the 3-year small business management program offered from Clatsop Community College and learned how to operate a strong small business. And we learned that we needed to expand and diversify into growing produce, keeping chickens for eggs and fertilizer and many other things. That would involve a lot of infrastructure and investment in infrastructure. And we tried very hard to work out a long-term lease on the land that we were farming on and were unable to come to an agreement with the landowners. And at that point realized that we needed to move our farm and preferably to land that we could own. It doesn't seem like a really complicated thing. We'd need to start a farm, we need to buy land, buy a farm. I live in a pretty rural community and there's a lot of farmland out there. We had a solid business plan and it was very pragmatic and it involved having part-time off-farm jobs to help keep our cash flow steady while we rebuilt our farm's infrastructure and got some crops started. Doesn't happen overnight. I don't know, how many of you go to local farmers markets? How do you mean you shop? That is so awesome. Thank you so much. I just want you to think about some of those farmers that are at those farmers markets. Think about your favorite farmer at one of those farmers markets. And I want you to know that our story could be their story. This story is very common from small farmers all throughout Oregon and all over the country. We had heard that it was very difficult to get loans from the USDA as a small farm loan, and so we thought, well, really, we're a small business, and so we're gonna try and get a small business loan. And we looked around, we found a great piece of property for sale. It was 18 acres, with a house and a barn and some outbuildings, and it had some well-drained soil on it, which, believe me, at the coast is like striking gold. And we started calling around to banks in our community to get a small business loan, to talk to them about a small business loan. And I called community banks, and I called national banks, and I called everything in between, and started to describe to them about our business. And as soon as the word farm came up, the conversation stopped. And they said, well, we don't do farm loans. And I said, well, we're a small business, and we need to move our small business to a new location. And they said, no, we just can't help you. And that went on and on. We finally did find a bank that was willing to work with us. It was actually Shore Bank, if you're interested. And they seemed excited about us and excited about organic small farming and community food systems and local agriculture. And they worked with us for quite a while. And we worked on our business plan. We worked on our proposal. And unfortunately for us, our farm loan went up for review in September of 2008, just as everything was hitting the fan and the economy was tanking and banks were failing. And ShoreBank decided that actually, you know, they'd rather pass on us. The irony was that the reason they turned us down was not, so they said, because we were too risky, but they said that because we wanted to live where our business took place, and because our business plan involved us having off-farm jobs in the beginning, that unless we could guarantee that 100% of the income that we would use to pay back the loan from day one would be coming from the farming, meaning no off-farm part-time jobs while we built our infrastructure, while we waited to have some crops to harvest, then what we were really asking them for was a home loan. And they don't do home loans. So they loved our idea. They thought it was great. They thought we were fabulous, but they just couldn't work with us. So we thought, okay, you know, let's go. We're going to go talk to the USDA about a small farm loan, because at least we're talking to people who understand the realities, the physical realities of agriculture. So we called the farm service agent closest to us and asked if we could meet with her, kind of give her a little background on our business, and she agreed to meet with us. And so we drove out to Tualatin and explained our business plan, described, you know, the property we wanted to buy. We anticipated maybe having 5 to 6 acres under cultivation, produce, cut flowers, herbs, plant starts, chickens, you know, a little bit of on-farm events to round it out. We have these part-time jobs to kind of even out the income stream, especially while we're rebuilding. We thought it was a really solid plan, and we had run our numbers backwards and forwards. And she looked at us, and she listened to us, and she was very polite. And she said, well, you know, the kind of farm that you're describing, this is, you know, for the USDA, this is what we call a lifestyle farm. And we don't really give loans for lifestyle farms. So we said, okay, yeah, thank you very much for that encouraging support. And we went home. And I, at that point, pretty much we were giving up. We tried private loans, we looked at becoming a nonprofit, we tried a lot of different things, and nothing really was working for us. And we decided we were just going to put our farm into hibernation until we could find a way to finance this. And we were offered some jobs, some real jobs, with paychecks, and we took them thinking we could save some money until we could figure out another way to do this. The property that we were interested in suddenly went back on the market. And the price had been reduced. This was now the summer of 2009. And we decided, what have we got to lose? Let's try and get a home loan and see if we can buy it that way. So we went to a bank, one of our local banks in Astoria, and talked to a mortgage broker about getting a home loan. And we talked about these great regular paycheck real jobs that we had. And they were so nice because we were in the middle of our best market season ever, if you can imagine how frustrating this was. It was so successful for us. And we were about to shut down. And we were working part-time at our real jobs, hoping to make it through that market season so that we could pay off, you know, our farm bills for that year. And the mortgage broker looked at our income, he looked at our jobs, he looked at the very generous down payment that our families were helping us with. And he said, you know, I think we can actually maybe, you know, we can maybe help you. And we said, that's great, you know, and isn't it great that we've got this, you know, part-time farm going in the background? That's going to really help us generate a little extra income. And he looked at us and he said, no farming. There can be absolutely no farming income in your income stream. You have to quit farming right now and only work your regular paycheck real jobs. And so we said, okay. And so July of that year, we quit farming. And the first lender that he tried to sell our loan to turned us down because they don't lend on agriculturally zoned property, they said. The second lender was willing to talk to us, but they were very worried about our history of farming. And so we were asked to write a letter to the lender acknowledging that we did have this history of farming. But that we had learned the error of our ways and we now had these great regular real jobs, and really we just wanted to buy 18 acres of land with a house and a barn that was owned agricultural because we wanted to continue living our rural lifestyle. And I have to tell you, it was, you feel like one. You, I mean, it's, It's not like I was trying to start a meth lab. Jeez, I'm trying to grow vegetables. I know. And so after several nail-biting months, we got a loan and were able to purchase the farm. And we're now working full-time, still at our jobs, and trying to rebuild our farm's infrastructure on the weekends and in the evenings. We're very determined to get back to full-time farming if possible, although recognizing that we may always need to have some part-time off-farm income in order to round out the edges. This is a story that I have heard from so many small farmers all over the state of Oregon, all over the country. These are the things that we encounter. We don't fit into anyone's criteria. No bank wants to touch us. We're too small to get a small farm loan from the USDA. And the kind of banking institution that Barbara's talking about here, have an Oregon State Bank that could help perhaps ease money into the stream through community banking, possibly through the state lending, would mean that small farmers like us could get on the land, could get loans, could have operating funds, and we generate a lot of income for this state. All of those farmers markets all over the state of Oregon generate lots of revenue for their communities. And if I can just give you a small example of that, out at the coast, there's a small town called Cannon Beach that maybe has about 3,000 year-round residents. And about 4 years ago, they started a farmers market, and we were one of the initial farms at that market. The first year, they estimated that they had about 24,000 people come through that market from the months of June through September on a Tuesday afternoon. The second year, it was closer to 34,000. And the city of Cannon Beach estimates that that market generates anywhere between $800,000 and $1 million for their economy on a Tuesday afternoon in the months of June through September. And that is because there are 20 to 25 farms that show up every week from June to September and sell their wares between the hours of 2 and 6. And that market would not exist without farms like us. And all of those farmers markets that you love to go to would not exist without farms like us. And we can't exist if we can't get financing. Thank you.
Our fourth speaker is stuck in traffic right now, so we're going to take advantage of this opportunity and get some questions from the audience. I know there are a lot of small business owners here in the audience, and so please ask questions about how the State Bank could help you in your business. David Delk, right here, is going to go around with a microphone. I and my co-host, my volunteer, Ashley, is going to help me collect comment cards. So there's index cards on your chair, so feel free to write a question on that, and I'll pick them up for you.
Do you have a copy of that HB 2972 here today?
Let me just say it's very easy to access this bill online. You go to the Oregon State Legislature website. At the top, there's a sort of toolbar kind of thing, and it says bills and laws or something like that. And you click on that, and it allows you to just put in for the 2011 session HB 2972. So you can get your own copy of it, as many of them as you want.
I'm glad you mentioned the problem of the bleeding of the Oregon Treasury by fees and the fee structures. That's one of the issues that attracted me most to the need for a state bank that you're talking about. Could you explain more about how those fees work?
Well, there's fees and there's fees and there's fees. I mean, it depends on whether it's an investment fee, you know, so the agents who are doing the investing for us charge fees, whether they are investment banks or financial managers of some sort. Private equity firms charge many fees. Everybody charges a fee basically to do the investing, but there are also banking fees for the money that the state of Oregon just banks. And so we pay fees for that. And among other things, people, for example, who are on unemployment, when they go to take, they have what looks like a debit card.
A Relia card.
Yeah. And when, and right. So you, you pay a fee, right, when you use the card. And that goes to the bank. And the same thing with the Oregon Trail card, and just general banking fees. Are you asking for an absolute number?
No, I'm not. How would the state bank avoid some of those fees?
Well, you would be paying the state bank. You would have to pay for the servicing, obviously, of the administering of whatever it was. But the profit margin that's made by all of these private entities would instead be made by the public. In other words, what profits are made in those fees, that then belongs to the public. It doesn't belong to the private owners of the bank or the private equity company or whatever.
Okay. Isn't it true that when in the contract with the Bank of America, the state of Oregon, the government of the state of Oregon has to pay a fee for every transaction, whether it's a deposit or writing a check, or every time they handle anything, they have to pay a fee to this corporate bank, and that fee goes to the corporate headquarters?
I think it's U.S. Bank, but yes. Yes. Exactly.
You mentioned something to the $60 to $80 billion that's available in this fund. Where does this money come from?
Well, there's several different funds, and when I said 60 to 80, it was 80 before the meltdown on Wall Street, then it went down to 60, and I can't really swear where it is right now. A high percentage of that, probably at least two-thirds, is in PERS. Okay, so that is the Public Employee Retirement System. It's a trust fund. There's a school trust fund. There's a lottery fund. Then there's the short-term fund, which is about $10.5 billion, which is the more liquid cash of the state. Then there are other pockets of money. You can find it all on the treasurer's website, actually.
And these are all public funds?
Yes, yes. They are all public funds, yes. Although, I don't know, would you call PERS public funds? Yes, but they're actually contractually owed to public employees. It's their pension fund. So I don't know if that qualifies as...
Who administrates this in the state of Oregon?
The treasurer's office. And then there's beneath the treasurer, or within the treasurer's office, there's the Oregon Investment Council, which oversees all of this. And then the separate funds have their own separate boards.
Okay, so from the cards, I've heard about problems with the state bank violating some part of the Oregon state constitution. What's the story with that?
Thank you. I actually came armed, if only I can find it, with the case. Where did I put that? I know. Okay, so yes, that's a rumor that's been spread wildly. It started with, I'm not saying who, but it was picked up by the Willamette Week. And it technically is true. The Oregon state constitution says that you shall not form a bank, but that the state shall not charter a bank. But in 1880, the Oregon Supreme Court pointed out that that was a misreading because there was a misplaced semicolon that had been put in there by the drafter when an amendment was removed from that particular section of that article of the Constitution. So let me read to you, okay? The Article 9, Section 1 of the Oregon Constitution provides, quote, "The Legislative Assembly shall not have the power to establish or incorporate any bank or banking company or moneyed institution whatever, semicolon, nor shall any bank company exist in this state with the privilege of making, issuing, or putting into circulation any bill, check, or other paper to circulate as money." The point of that section of the Constitution was to say that you can't print money in the state of Oregon. You can't print money in any state. The U.S. Constitution, for those of you who have read it, points that out as well. In the case called State of Oregon versus Hibernian Savings and Loan Association, 1880, the Supreme Court of the state said that the semicolon in that provision was the result of a clerical error. And they concluded that all that was intended by the convention in adopting the amendment was to place corporations from other states under the same restrictions as those incorporated in this state. All alike were to be prohibited from making, issuing, or putting banknotes in circulation as money. That case has never been questioned since 1880. So the Willamette Week, I did send them a letter, but Nigel often doesn't listen.
The one last speaker asked about the state treasurer. And what is the state treasurer? Does he have an opinion on this idea? And where? Also, just who's in support? Where is the opposition going to come from?
The state treasurer has an opinion. He has sent a letter to the legislature saying what he would and what he would not support in a state bank. It's pretty much in conformance with what we support and don't support in a state bank, so we're feeling pretty positive about that. The treasurer's office is here in the person of somebody back in the back of the room who will be happy to mingle with all of you later on and chat up the state bank, Mike Salvaggio. And where will the opposition come from? The Oregon Bankers Association will oppose, and the Oregon Bankers Association is made up of Wall Street banks, big banks, out-of-state banks, local banks, small banks, all banks. Sound like Dr. Seuss, don't I? Anyhow, all banks are in the Oregon Bankers Association, and the loudest voice sometimes comes from the biggest banks. So we expect opposition from them. We're hoping we can work it out, shall we say.
I'm curious of your perspective on why the banks are so wary of any loans to farms for farming. I've heard this story before. It implies that there's a level of risk that they're not willing to accept with that. And I'm wondering, in terms of the state bank, is the state bank designed to be nonprofit to a certain extent? Is there a different orientation that a state bank might take? Or are the banks, commercial banks, just missing an opportunity and not understanding that there's a market that they could be providing a service to?
I think one of the big problems is that small farms especially don't have a lot of collateral, and banks are really unwilling to lend under those circumstances. So they love having a paycheck, a regular paycheck, and certain guarantees like that. And I think that that's one of the reasons why it makes it seem so risky to small banks. I think part of it is also that they just don't seem to really understand our businesses very well. We don't fit into sort of conventional business models. And, you know, the feeling that I got from some of the small banks that I talked to, and I did talk to our local community bank, it's a locally owned community bank in Clatsop County, and, you know, I could tell that they wanted to help us, but they just couldn't because we were sort of outside their risk parameters. They weren't, you know, allowed to do that. They didn't want to have that on their books if something went bad. So I don't know. I mean, I don't think it's that we would be asking the, you know, Oregon State Bank to be taking on a whole bunch of really bad loans, because you shouldn't be loaning to people who don't have a viable business plan and a real chance of making it. You know, when I first started farming in 2003, I wouldn't have given me a loan. You know, I didn't know what I was doing back then. But in 2009, I knew what I was doing. I had a solid business plan. We had a plan, and we were not so stupid that we were going to do. I mean, I wasn't going to do anything to risk that land, and I won't do anything to risk that land. I'm not going to default on that loan. So I think sometimes they just don't really understand, and I don't know if it's the same kind of things with small business and small business getting loans, but it's...
Go ahead, Jim, do you want
to... How would a state bank differ?
Let me use the example of the Bank of North Dakota, because I think that helps. It's been in existence now for 90 years, and they have turned a nice profit, actually. In the last 10 years, they returned $350 million to the state coffers, and that's profit above what they need to continue lending as a bank. So it is very much a revenue center. But that's, as I say, that's not going to happen quickly. One of the things about the state bank is that it's not that it's not for profit, it's that the profit belongs to the people. And that's a very different paradigm, shall we say. And it, in North Dakota, the bank was started by farmers, and precisely because of the kinds of questions about how banks do or don't lend to farmers. They do represent a different paradigm than small businesses of other sorts, or homeowners, or the other kinds of commercial loans that might be done. One of the things that the Bank of North Dakota does now is that it has a, I can't remember what the acronym stands for, but it has a loan portfolio called PACE loans, where they lower the interest rate. It's not no interest, but it's lower than market rate interest rates for startup farmers, small farms and startup farms. And it's because they want to encourage young farmers or new farmers in the state of North Dakota. We should be doing the same here in the state of Oregon. It's not, they get paid back. They don't, those are not loans that default. So it's not a loss, but it's not market rate. They will, the other loans that they make, and these are all made in participation with community banks. So just, I want to keep emphasizing that. It's not in competition with the community banks, but they will allow for the community banks to draw their interest rates down. So when you have an economic development initiative on the part of the state, whether it's for a certain kind of business, whether it's for young people starting a business, young people starting a farm, whatever it might be, that the state, as a state, chooses to incentivize, then the state bank can provide a loan at, or provide money via a community bank or a credit union at a lower interest rate to help make that more possible. By the way, the state of the North Dakota Bank also has been doing student loans. It's been a very large part of its portfolio. And we initially were talking about student loans. It's a big part of what we want the Bank of Oregon or the State Bank to do. And the reason we've sort of pulled that out of our dialogue a little bit is because in the federal health plan that got passed, the Obama health plan that got passed, there was a piece in there, excuse me, about direct federal loans to students. So nobody knows, including the Bank of North Dakota right now, just what that's going to mean really for lending for students. But if it doesn't do what needs to be done, we can also provide loans for Oregon students at decent rates.
My question is about regulation, and in today's world, I don't think that the public has much faith or confidence in the elected officials to provide any kind of regulatory structure that's trustworthy. So what's different about this bank that would secure that sense of trust and confidence to the public at a very critical time and does protect the bank's activities?
Well, there are layers to that question. One is, keep in mind, this is not money we're inventing. This is money that is already being invested and deposited by state officials. The treasurer's office already has control over that amount of money, and it's putting it in banks or in investment houses or in private equity firms or whatever it might be. So it's not like we're putting it at greater risk. We're not changing that dynamic. One thing we do want to do, we want this bank, by the way, to be regulated. I mean, it's obviously going to be regulated as any bank would be regulated. But one of the things we want to do is to use this opportunity to also consolidate a lot of the state's lending programs that are now scattered all over in different agencies and with different mandates and different people running them and different mandates, I guess is the best way to put it. And if you consolidate those and bring those together under management, that the way we frame it is, we want this bank run by people who know how to run a bank. So it's not just someone who, you know, used to be doing something else in an agency and they get hired to run a lending program. It's going to be somebody with actual experience in banking who will be the president of the bank, who will then be hiring people to run the bank. So we're hoping there will be a little more expertise. Interestingly enough, on the Oregon Investment Council, there are no bankers. There are five people on the Investment Council right now. One of them is the treasurer of the state. And then there, I'm going to forget who all's there, somebody from Intel, somebody, Harry Demarest from Forest stuff. I'm going to get this wrong. Timber, I don't know. Forest Products, thank you. And Gus Solomon's son, whose name is Richard, who is a CPA, and a woman who is in real estate financing or something like that, who is the chair, and I can't remember her name. So it's not bankers. And, you know, it's our humble opinion that there should be some bankers involved in making these decisions, but they should be making them based on criteria that serve the economy of the state.
Okay, from the cards, would a state bank make it easier to create a microloan program for property owners to make repairs to homes and buildings?
I don't know.
Okay, that was easy. Barbara can't know everything.
Again, I don't know. I have no idea. I mean, I don't think anyone knows at this point. We're way far from having that kind of specificity in what sorts of programs this bank would be funding. Good idea. You could, you know, send it in.
Okay. And the second question, what has been the impact on credit to farm small businesses in North Dakota?
North Dakota has not had a recession. Just saying.
I just wanted to add a little bit more information concerning the Rely card. So that's through U.S. Bank. Mm-hmm. And we've had it for a couple of years, and it does save the state a lot of money in terms of being able to not have to deal with checks, paper checks all the time, that at times get stolen. The state of California has the same type, the Rely card through U.S. Bank. They don't charge any fees to the claimants. We do. Last year at one time, we had about $2 billion sitting in our UI fund, unemployment fund. That part of that money comes from the businesses in this state. So it would be great if there was some way to use that. I could certainly you know live on that interest. And the rest of us in this room.
Right.
Nowadays, we are spending about $47 to $48 million a week in unemployment benefits. A couple of months ago, for months, it was like almost $70 million a week in unemployment benefits. That money is just sitting there. And there ought to be a way to put it into a bank like that to be the basis for the bank. I just wanted to add to that.
I wanted to know how North Dakota restricts access to the lending capacity of the state bank. I mean, is it in the Constitution? Is it in statute? Is it just in policy? And is it change from month to month? Because, of course, if they're providing cheaper credit, then there are going to be all sorts of folks out there who would like some. And they may actually have offices in Wall Street. So that's a straightforward.
I'm not sure I know the answer to that. Okay, but first of all, let me say, there is the basic outline of the Bank of North Dakota is in their constitution. There is then legislative. Since 1921, there have been different pieces of legislation that have altered this program or that program of the Bank of North Dakota. Not that many, though, actually, surprisingly. And a lot of it is just bank policy. The loans are not available to people outside of the state of North Dakota.
The question is how?
How is that so? They just say so. It's their bank. I see Jefferson out of the corner of my eye, didn't I?
Yeah, Jefferson has arrived. So we're going to take one more question and then go from there.
Teresa, I'm wondering if the, what was it, the lifestyle farm loan is because You're dealing in non-commodity products that have no federal subsidies on them from the Department of Agriculture, and so don't have a guaranteed return to the lending institution?
I don't know that that's really the criteria for the lifestyle designation. The USDA has several different ways that it defines small farms, and for farms earning under $100,000 a year, you can either be a limited resource farm, you can be a residential slash lifestyle farm, or you can be a farming business low income person, and those are your three options. And I think the lifestyle is more designated because if you have farm, if you have income that's coming from off farm, so if you have any kind of part-time job, or one of the people that's running the farm has a job elsewhere, maybe they're a nurse or they are a contractor or something, and that's part of the income stream for the farm, they don't really consider you to be a real farm. I imagine the commodity thing is an issue as well. Certainly the FSA loan officer told us that in their designation, a small farm is more someone that's maybe selling, you know, growing 300 acres of grass seed, and that's a small farm. So, you know, we didn't really fit into that description at all.
So I guess Jefferson is not quite ready to make his appearance yet. So we have another question here.
This might be a little too specific, but would the State Bank issue Visa cards and MasterCards?
I don't know the answer to that either. Jared, do you have an opinion on that question? I think not is my probable answer, because it's not going to be a retail bank. It's not going to be a bank where you and I can go and deposit our money or, for the most part, get direct loans. It's going to be something that is more designed to shore up the community banks. Now, the community banks right now have to go to MBNA, MNBA, whatever the heck it is, for their Visa cards and their MasterCards. They're not their own. And so could the state bank provide that as one of their banker's bank services to community banks, so we could actually have a Visa card that's the Oregon Visa card or something? That would be lovely. I don't know how those things work, honestly. I mean, I'm, you know, winging it here, so. But I don't see why not. Opinions? Anyone? Anyone who knows more than me back there? I know there you're out there.
Barbara, the main comment I've heard about this runs kind of along the lines of, well, the fear of something so unusual. Are there any major disadvantages of a state bank? After all, if it's so good, why is there only one in the whole country?
That's a question, actually. I'm glad you asked that question, Judy, because that's a question I hear a lot, mostly from legislators and or, you know, well, anyhow. But I think there's some real answers to it. Remember when, you know, people will say, if the Bank of North Dakota is so great, why aren't there a lot more? Well, remember 1919. Put that in historical perspective in your head. What was happening then was, first of all, they were starting to get a grip federally on the instability of our economic system. Grip is maybe an overstatement, but they were trying. And so that was when we first had the Federal Reserve invented. And it wasn't long after that. It was like 10 years later that the Great Depression started. And as a result, we ended up with the SEC, and we ended up with the FDIC, and we ended up with the Glass-Steagall Act, and we ended up with a lot of federal solutions to the instability problems, the instability of the financial system. My personal analysis is that we've now sort of exhausted that system, and it started being dismantled under Reagan. It was really dismantled under Clinton, and then the George W. Bush administration did it in. So we no longer have a federal system that really protects us and maintains any kind of stability. And so I think the ideas come back around. And there are about 12 states that are looking quite seriously at a state bank at this point in time. We happen to be way ahead of the pack, as always.
Could you talk about the legislative strategy? For example, do you anticipate a bill being introduced on the Senate side? And also, will the governor sign a bill?
I hear your voice. Where are you, Janice? Oh, hi. I don't really know the answer to that yet. I'd love to have a bill introduced. If you asked me a week from now whether we'll also have a bill on the Senate side, I'd probably be able to tell you. We want whatever bill is out there to be bipartisan. Jensen's bill is, I think, just the first of several. And there's going to be, there's a lot of negotiating going on right now, refining what started out as Phil Barnhart of the Revenue Committee had started working on a different legislative council draft, not that different from Jensen's, frankly. And that's being negotiated, amended, et cetera, now. So a lot's going to happen in the next 2 weeks. And so I really don't know. All I can tell you is that we're committed to making this bipartisan all the way through, because one of the things we're finding is that, as I said before, the usual divide between Republicans and Democrats in this state, as in many states, is really a rural-urban divide. And what we're finding is that this resonates just as much, if not more, in rural areas as it does in urban areas. And a lot of Republicans either are farmers or have small businesses and understand, I mean, they could be sitting up here describing the same credit crunch. So we want this to be a big idea for Oregon as Oregon, and not to be one party or the other. And frankly, this evenly divided House has offered an incredibly interesting opportunity to have that kind of discussion where, you know, neither party is going to bring this forward. It's going to be something more unifying than that. And will the governor sign it? You better believe it.
So from the question cards, other than Oregon funds, what other money would fund the bank? Or is it just Oregon funds that would be the only source of funding?
Yes. It is only Oregon funds that would be the source of funding, unless one wants to talk about where that money gets printed and stuff.
Okay, and I understand that Jefferson is now ready to enter the room. There he is.
Hail to the chief we were working on.
Hi. It's one way to strategize to be the closing speaker. So I want to say a few things. First of all, please and thank you. I saw Tom Chamberlain as I was walking in, the Oregon head of the FL-CIO, and the last time he heard me give a speech was in front of a relatively large crowd when the president was here, and I told a particular story. And I realized, one of my very favorite stories, and I realized that after that, I couldn't tell that story again for at least, you know, several years. Reminded me of a time when there was a poem that I used to tell stories to. I really liked it. And what happened? No, it's going to be good. No, you have to put up with this part, you know, for a second. And a story I used to tell, and I didn't tell it. And a guy came up to me afterwards with a friend of his, and he said, I came to hear you speak before, and you told a particular story. And I brought a friend with me this time, and you didn't tell the story. And I'm never coming to listen to you again. Which does, Barbara, make me think of a story. When I was a small child, my dad, this is an interesting cat. This is the guy who named me Jefferson Smith and named my older brother Lincoln. Okay, true story. Okay, so he's a different kind of cat. In our family, on Halloween, you couldn't just trick or treat. You couldn't just come to our house and knock on the door and expect to receive candy, because that would be begging. You had to perform a skit or sing a song or tell a joke to earn your Tootsie Pop. And this is very embarrassing for the other people in the family. And you know, kid would come up, trick or treat, do your skit, do you have a joke? So we lobbied our father until ultimately we succeeded in regime change. We didn't, like, oust our father. He sort of became a more typical Halloween family. And inevitably that year came up our many steps, a four-year-old girl dressed as a fairy princess holding her mother's hand, knocking on our door with her barely a fist. We opened it. She said, "Trick or treat." And we put a piece of candy in her bag, and her eyes filled up with tears. And her mother said, "You don't understand. She's been preparing her skit all year." So now you come to our house on Halloween, and you have to perform a skit or do a joke or perform a dance, and I tell stories. I want to say just a few things about why I'm encouraged by the effort here and by Barbara's work and by the community leaders who are talking. We hear a lot about access to capital challenges, right? And the only answer I've heard, and I've asked, you know, and we did lots of meetings, and not just the kind of meetings you do because you're trying to win re-election. By the way, I was going to win re-election, right? It wasn't all that close in my district. It was a challenging district, but I'm so nice. But the kind of meetings you do where you're actually trying to learn. What are the challenges that are facing the state? How do we build additional opportunities for access to capital? And one idea I heard was, well, we could further deregulate the banking industry because that has been proven to build stability in our economy over time. So trying to figure out a way that we can increase access to capital for Oregon homegrown businesses, at the same time not remove significantly the protections of sort of our fiscal system, seems like a legitimate thing to pursue. Hear all the time how, if you talk to construction workers, if you talk to farmers, if you talk to sort of people who are economic development folks, the need to have resources for economic development priorities. Not just sort of state social programs, things that I like and people in my district care about, but, you know, sort of the hard-minded stuff of how are we going to compete in a global economy over time. If we want to retrofit a bunch of public schools and put a bunch of people to work, right, how are we going to fund those projects? If we want to be a global leader in sustainable agriculture, how are we going to sort of get from here to there, right? And we don't hear a lot of appetite for significant increases in general taxation to fund those things. So finding opportunities to fund economic development priorities in our state without raising taxes seems like a really important conversation for the state to have. And one that nobody should be scared of having. And I assure you, there are many people scared of having it. Me too. I almost didn't come. No, I came. And it shouldn't be daunting. We should be willing to have a vigorous conversation about how we structure our financial sector and how do we better use state dollars. Because there's a bunch of other people who are having rallies, and not all of them are here, by the way, who are having rallies about critiquing the inefficiency of government processes and government structures. So figuring out how we can better leverage state dollars, keep them in the state, and not just to an out-of-state business, but to more in-state businesses, and not just so we're losing the money on the float, but so we're better leveraging the money on the float, this seems like a legitimate conversation to have, and one that we shouldn't be scared of having. In fact, we should be scared of not having it. You can clap, that's fine. So one of the questions I heard, I have a couple more things and I'll shut up. Don't clap at that. One of the questions I heard was, well, if it was so great, how come it hasn't been done 50 times or 49 more? And I think, you know, I'll defer to Barbara's answer. I think it was really helpful. But the other is, I think that what is during Oregon's greatest period of policy development, it was not a deterrent that other states weren't already doing it. But in fact, it was an encourager, right? At the times when this state has set an example to the nation of what a place can be like, when we have been willing to answer history's questions with a different set of responses, the state that built the bottle bill, that did public beaches, did land use planning, first state to publicly recognize Labor Day, to first enforce the minimum wage, the first state to do vote by mail. The question was, well, haven't 15 states already figured it out? Because then we might just dip our toe into that already pee-ridden water. I haven't said that before. I don't know that I will again. You will not notice it in the prepared words. Or just think it's sort of a swimming pool, you know, a lot of people in there already. You know what I'm saying. But rather that we were willing to be policy innovators, and to me, that's the heart of our state. And that's more at our best. And not when the triangulation of the existing status quo power structure says, oh, well, you might be willing to do a little piece of that. But if we instead say, what are the biggest challenges facing our state? What are the best ideas to answer them? And let's move towards there. Rather than building ideas around where the power is, building power around where the ideas are. And I think that, and one of the biggest reasons I'm honored and sort of might not just please as a thank you and sort of want to encourage and thank you, is I think that's what's bringing a lot of people to this party. And I mean a little pea party, but maybe a big pea party as well. Is that there that are, that I think even, let's take a different big pea party, let's take the Tea Party. I think even they are motivated by an overlapping critique that the systems of government seem to be mostly based on the preservation of the status quo, not on the accomplishment of common problems. And we need to be better able and better willing to build new power centers to answer hard questions. And that's why nobody should be afraid of having this conversation, and in fact, why people should be afraid of not having it. And that's why I thank you. The last thing I want to say is because overall, I think the biggest question facing the world, the biggest question facing the United States of America, the biggest question facing our state is how do you build a high road economy? How do you build an economic system that is prosperous, that is sustainable, that is just? And how do you do it in a global context? And how do you do it in this century? And I think most other political questions, not all, it's important civil rights questions, but the huge portion of political questions are either subsets of that basic question or distractions and hogwash. And we need to figure out how to better answer it. And we need to come up with a different set of answers, that the only way for Oregon to compete economically is for us to be the cheapest date. Right? There are other ways to drive an economy other than a new set of tax breaks. By the way, that used to be 33% of the overall potential general fund. Now it's about 50%. Right now we are spending about the same on tax breaks as we are in education, public safety, and healthcare combined. That doesn't mean I don't like tax breaks. There's a lot of them I like a lot. A lot. But it does mean we can't play only that game and keep playing that game forever. Right? So we got to consider things like this. So I want to say thank you. I want to say thank you for being willing to be innovators. Thank you for being sort of capacity builders of challenging, publicly interested conversations. Thank you for being sort of different economic thinkers about how we can build a cultivation theory of the economy, not only race to the bottom, but a race to the top. I want to thank you for all those things. I want to say please. And why don't we give to the people who are really putting shoulder to the wheel on this stuff, including you, including the people up here, a hip, hip hooray, because that's sort of fun. Hip, hip. Hooray. We can do louder. Hip, hip. Louder, hip, hip.
Hooray!
Thanks, everybody. I appreciate your time.
We're going to take a couple more questions. We're going to start right here.
Could state funds be invested in home weatherization under Oregon's HB 2626 from Jules Bailey? And might this be a function of the state bank?
I didn't follow that question. Say it more slowly.
Could state funds be invested in home weatherization under Oregon's HB 2626 of 2009 from Jules Bailey? And might this be a function of the state bank?
The state bank is really about lending, not granting, although there, so it depends on what the structure is, and I would be hard-pressed. Is there someone in the room who can tell me more? Perhaps you can. More about Jules, about that bill, so that I can understand how it might fit in. Yeah, go for it, Jeff.
I believe the structure of the East bill is that loans would be repaid through reductions in energy bills. In other words, the energy efficiency, the weatherization, right, reduces your usage, you pay the same bill, and the excess goes to pay the loan. So it would seem to me it could be a function of the state bank, as could the program I've been working on, which is low-interest loans to finance renewable energy development, rather than tax breaks.
Yeah, so one, sort of the array of options that all might fit within this branded category, right, which all might count as a state bank or something similar, one option would be to do it focused around energy efficiency projects, right? You could also do it more broadly and include that with an explicit category and just say, hey, again, it's not going to be sort of retail bank, it's not an ATM cards for justice, it's sort of different than that, and the and so we have a few categories, and one of them is energy efficiency projects. My own thought would be it would depend on the statute, but there are huge policy reasons to include both that as well as in public buildings. And I make the case on public buildings because not only do you get the jobs benefits and the energy efficiency benefits, but you also get the cost savings benefits over time, and they're sort of egalitarianly, if that's even a word, used by whomever uses the public buildings.
Thank you. It seems like we're talking a lot about what the bank is going to do, and I think I've read a little bit about the Bank of North Dakota, and what you mentioned about them being a banker's bank, I think in order to make it more friendly to the business community, we need to talk about how they help banks. The Bank of North Dakota is in place to add extra financing for Shore Bank so that when you go to Shore Bank and you're looking for a loan, they have the backup capital to be able to take on the extra risk. And then one question I had is just the initial startup capital. You can't put the trust, the pension fund, into something like this. So how do you see financing something like this from ground one?
That is very much still under discussion. There are several options. The most obvious one is government bonds for capitalization. There's a difference for those of you who are not steeped in banking. There is a difference between capitalization and deposits. So the state will be depositing funds which it would deposit in other institutions. It will be depositing those funds in the state bank, but it will capitalize so as to cover the lending that is done. That's the question, right? And the capitalization, the first assumption was it would be government-issued bonds. And I particularly liked that because I could imagine us selling those bonds through community banks and having them in small enough denominations that any Oregonian could buy a bond for their own state bank, which was very appealing and may still very well come to fruition. There are other pockets of money. We're talking in the hundreds of millions when I say pockets. It's not our pockets of money that the state has that could be used more quickly than government-issued bonds. Government-issued bonds would require a vote on a constitutional amendment. It's not a constitutional amendment, but it requires a vote of the populace of Oregon in order to do government-issued bonds. So it would take a while. So that's still, as I say, very much under discussion, what that source is. I have my own personal favorite, which I throw out all the time, and some people roll their eyes and other people smile, which is the kicker. We've had a lot of agonizing over how the heck we're going to get our kicker back. And this seems to me to be a perfect opportunity to put it somewhere where it's not the general fund. It's not just going to go back out, which is what seems to aggravate people so much. Instead, it's going to go into a bank, and it's going to be used to stimulate the Oregon economy, to lend to businesses, to lend to farms, et cetera. So it may be the sort of idea that can appeal across the usual ideological divide on the question of the kicker. So I'm holding out for that one.
Hi. A few months ago, I attended one of Randy Gregg's Bright Light sessions where he interviewed the CEO of Umpqua Bank, who claimed to be our largest community bank in Oregon, and actually they're also in California and Washington and maybe a few other states by now, but in any case. And he had made, his first name was Ray, I can't remember his last, it might have been just something simple like Smith, but anyway, Ray had mentioned that he wasn't doing any loans for housing, so during the question and answer session, I asked about whether he meant he wasn't doing any loans for the kind of mixed-use, transit-oriented development that so many of our young people wanted to live in, and so many of our baby boomer population wanted to live in, the kind of, you know, development we really need to see these days. And I also had a conversation with Tom Hughes, the new president of Metro, and he said he had heard, and I think this is quite true from my own experience, because I'm one of them, that the architecture, engineering, and planning profession, our unemployment rate was about 45% in Oregon. I'm wondering if, in fact, the State Bank will help us out in a sense of helping to be, you know, is there any way that it can help credit unions, perhaps, or other community banks other than Umpqua fund the kind of new development that we need in Oregon?
Broadly speaking, that's the whole point. You know, in terms of specifics, there is, I mean, we do have to pay attention to the fact that we're talking about investing our state's money and lending it out. We want to lend it out in ways that it will not be lost. We are not talking about a risky venture here where we're going to take the state's money and put it into things that no banker in their right mind would lend to. We're talking about doing market-driven lending, basically making it possible for community banks and credit unions to do the lending that they haven't been able to do since the big banks pulled back and, you know, tried to accumulate capital to pay off their TARP loans, et cetera. There will be the opportunity, as I said before, to do some mission-driven lending, shall we say, that where you draw down interest rates to make it possible for things to happen that might not be able to happen at market rates. But we're not giving the money away, and we're not you know, taking wild and crazy chances, because this is our money. So, you know, I don't really know how to answer that, but yes, to do the kind of economic development Oregon needs and that would be good for Oregon, that's the whole point here.
There's an emergent phenomena of complementary currencies that help develop and stabilize local economies and local food source, food securities, and help move towards steady state economies and economics. And you made it really clear that our Constitution says the state bank can't print currencies. Can it help to it be an exchange partner to? With if there are local currencies developed so that these currencies might be used at least in part to help pay state taxes and local taxes and property taxes, and thereby help allow us to be much more self-sufficient and take care of ourselves and our issues?
Let me be blunt. I would stay very, very, very far away from that question for the first decade of the state bank's existence. Because we would be setting ourselves up for the opponents of the bank, who will be quite wealthy, to challenge it and tie it up in court forever and ever and ever. And we do not want that to happen. Whether that happens sometime after, you know, 2022, we'll see.
All right. I know you all have more questions, but the panel will be available for you to mingle with afterwards. We also would, if you guys are encouraged by tonight's form, and if you want to join the campaign, fill out this pink card, and Ashley and Kathy will collect them for you. Thank you, panel. We appreciate your presentation tonight. And thank all of you for coming out and supporting this event. Thank you.